welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, answers to your emails and your calls. Wow. How can we fit all of that into an hour? Well, stay tuned and you'll find out. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika and I'd love to talk with you. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. I'm going to start with an email right out of the box. This from Inez in Spain. She wants to know about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, sometimes called SIBO. And I won't read her email as it's quite long. And Inez, I will write to you because you had a lot of detailed questions and I don't want to try to do this on the air. But I do want to emphasize that in Spain, the doctors are thinking and talking about something that our gastroenterologists are just barely beginning to acknowledge as a legitimate problem. So if you are a person who finds that you have abdominal and distension, bloating and belching right after a meal, say within a half an hour, do this experiment. Try eating a completely protein meal, no starch or sugar, and see if you get the same thing. If you don't, then your problem is probably bacteria in the small intestine, maybe even in your stomach, fermenting the sugar that you eat and the starch that you eat and turning it into gas. There is a functional medicine treatment for that, and I will be talking about that sometime in the future. But for now, I just wanted to thank Inez for giving us a chance to discuss that. And I have some interesting news stories today. About 130 years ago, William Halstead performed the first radical mastectomy for breast cancer, transforming what had been a completely incurable cancer into one which could be cured, at least in some circumstances. Now, 130 years later, we may be reaching the end of an era as far as breast cancer surgery is concerned. In Stockholm, Sweden, some innovative researchers are actually doing a very interesting non-surgical treatment for breast cancer. They use a little metal probe. They use ultrasound to guide the electrode into the tumor, and the tumor has to be smaller than 10 millimeters or 1 centimeter, a little under half an inch. They then heat the tumor up to 167 degrees. This effectively kills the tumor, destroys all of the DNA within the tumor, and prevents it from spreading, and it leaves the surrounding tissue unharmed, so the body is able to essentially digest and remove the tumor. This is early, and we don't have long-term data yet, but there's a good reason to believe that if this is done on tumors that have not yet spread, it will be curative, and it may represent a very new era in breast cancer. In a related breast cancer story, well, we learn as we go. And in the case of DES, which is diethylstilbestrol, a synthetic estrogen that was used to prevent miscarriages up until the mid-1970s, we learned the hard way. About 15 or 20 years after the drug was first introduced, an unusual kind of cervical cancer started showing up in the daughters of women who'd taken that drug. Well, it didn't take long to pull the drug off the market, but unfortunately, we have an entire generation of people who were exposed. In the United States alone, more than 2 million women are DES daughters. Now, men also have problems with this. Those problems that men tend to relate to fertility, not quite so big an issue as cervical cancer, although a significant one. Now, as these women enter their 40s and 50s, we're finding out that there's another problem, and that is the breast cancer rates are just about double. So new information for DES daughters. The average woman has a 1 in 50 chance of developing breast cancer by the age of 55. For DES daughters, it's 1 in 25. And since the oldest women in this cohort are just entering their 60s, we really don't know what happens later on. What we do know is enough to make us very worried, and what we know about epigenetics now is making us worried about the grandchildren of these women who took DES. We're still not sure what's going to happen with them. This story I thought was just fun. It's like the very, very modern version of a caveman. If you're a caveman and you're walking and you see an animal that's lying there not moving, what do? Well, you take a stick and you poke it and you see if it moves. That's how you tell if it's dead or alive, right? Well, at the electron microscopy level, researchers are now doing essentially the same thing with cells. They've invented, they're calling it a golf club. It's basically shaped like a golf club. And they're using it to test whether a cell is alive. This is the concept. Cells stick to each other by virtue of having charge on their outer surface. The more charge, the stickier the cell. When cells are dead, they don't maintain the same amount of charge on their outer surface. They don't display those antigens, which themselves have a charge, so they don't stick as well. So researchers have invented a microputter. It's about 240 micrometers long, and the tip is just 2 micrometers. So that's about a quarter the size of a typical red blood cell. So this thing is tiny. They use it to test whether cells are alive or dead on a surface in like culture media. And using scanning electron microscopy, they can capture images of the cells, they can poke them, and they can see if the cells split apart. Cells that don't stick together well are dead. And this can be used to understand the mechanisms of disease, help develop new drugs. And it's just plain fun and geeky to think of inventing this tiny little microscopic stick that you can poke cells with. And like I said, takes us back to the caveman days. We're going to go to our first caller. And that is Larry in Atlanta. Hello, Larry, and welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. Thank you so very much. As always, well, as you can guess, I'm your biggest fan in the state of Georgia, as you can guess.
Well, thank you very much.
A couple of fast questions. First, I'm taking good advice and seeing a quote, friendly urologist this coming week about my condition, number one. Okay, number two, as I'm sure you know, there has been a tremendous amount of news about the recent report concerning the PSA test. I'm calling you to get your opinion about that. I've also heard that the urologist organization is going to make a counterclaim about the report. But, you know, my concern is, you know, as urologists are so involved in the treatment of prostate cancer.
Right.
And I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to anticipate what you were going to say. Urologists make a lot of money from treating prostate cancer. So naturally, they have a conflict of interest. But the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force themselves have something of a conflict of interest. And this is the problem with these kinds of pronouncements. Here's the framework, okay? What are we trying to do when we talk about Preventive Services Task Force? We're trying to talk about what is cost-effective for a society to do. Let's emphasize cost-effective. I'll tell you a story. This same U.S. Preventive Services Task Force came out with a pronouncement 15, 20 years ago where they said, you know, we really shouldn't screen for herpes in women because even when women have active herpes, what we would have to do in case of a woman in labor is we would do a C-section. The reason for that is to avoid the child passing through a herpes-contaminated birth control and getting herpes encephalitis, which can cause brain damage or death, rarely. But you know, from a cost-effectiveness standpoint, it's very expensive to screen every woman who's in labor for herpes using one of these tests. And, you know, we only lose 1 or 2 infants a year to encephalitis. So it makes absolutely no sense to screen for this disease because all we're going to save is a few babies. And, you know, society can handle losing a few babies. So, I mean, that's an extreme example. And let me just say that they did not word it that way, but that's how I read it. It was, you know, as a society making a social utilitarian decision, that makes sense. And the same thing happened a few years ago when they came down and said women in their 40s don't get mammograms because it's not cost effective. We have to do 100,000 mammograms to prevent one death from breast cancer. And so it's not worth the money. You know, 200 per mammogram, multiply that. That's $2 million per year to save one life. And so that's not cost effective. Well, if you're the person whose life gets saved, you probably think that $2 million is money well spent. So whenever we look at these pronouncements, we have to understand the context of the considerations that are being used. Now, in terms of prostate cancer, this pronouncement was based specifically on 2 studies, one of which ran for 9 years and the other which ran for 10 years. The one that ran for 9 years showed that you got a somewhat reduction in death rate, 30% age-adjusted death rate reduction for men, and it was, as I said, a 9-year study. These were men from 55 to 69, which would be the group where you'd expect to see a life extension benefit. The other study was very similar, ran for 10 years, did not find a benefit. So we have one that shows 30%, one that shows no benefit. It's exactly like the breast cancer and estrogen studies that were coming out, 15, 20 years ago. Same exact thing. And there's a study that's quoted in Europe that ran a little bit longer. This was a Scandinavian study that went 14 years, and it showed about a 50% decrease in death. Guess what? The longer you follow cancer, the more people die. So the more statistically significant improvement in mortality you're going to see over time. So this is not too much of a surprise. So the real question is, if there's a benefit, but it's small to men between 50 and 69, should we as a society screen that group and take the hit that's going to come in terms of the false positives, in terms of the unnecessary surgeries, in terms of the people who end up having a surgery that they would have died from a heart attack in 5 years, but the last 5 years that they spent, they were impotent and they had to wear a diaper because their prostate was removed for a prostate cancer that wasn't going to kill them anyway because they were going to die of a heart attack. How do you answer a question like that? And I guess what I'm saying is I believe that the proper thing to do based on what we know now is to screen the younger men. So once you hit 50, screen. If you find it, there are other studies we can do that kind of tell us how aggressive it is. We can monitor. Maybe we shouldn't be doing surgery right away. Maybe we should monitor everybody for a while. But throwing it out and saying, no, we're not going to test PSA on anybody, we're going to have people die. Just like those babies who got herpes encephalitis, it's going to be a cost-effective death, but I don't necessarily think that we want to base our policy primarily on cost-effectiveness. It's a difficult problem, and I think this is just added fuel to the fire, and I'm anticipating what the urologists say. I think what they say will also be science-based.
Can I ask you a fast question?
You bet.
Okay. I also heard and read that maintaining one's good health, exercising, eating well, things like that, has a direct effect on the health of your prostate gland. Have you heard anything, about that?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. First of all, low-fat diet, particularly saturated fat, strong statistical association with prostate cancer rates. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, exercise. Again, something about exercise seems to lower cancer across the board. Three, cooked tomato products. Turns out tomato sauce is very protective against prostate cancer. Tomatoes have a compound called lycopene, not easy to get from raw tomatoes because it doesn't absorb well, very easy to get from cooked tomatoes, and you reduce your risk of prostate cancer by 20 to 30% by eating tomato sauce a couple of times a week. So that's an easy one.
Doctor, thank you so very, very much.
Thank you, and good luck. I hope your lump on the prostate turns out not to be a prostate cancer. Good luck to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We're going to go now to Madine and Ben Lomond. Hello, and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy that you're here.
Well, thank you. What can I do for you today?
Well, I have three seemingly unrelated things going on, but I have a feeling that they are related on reflexology or a T level.
Well, they're all happening in the same body, so by definition, they're related. Go ahead and tell me about them.
Well, the first one has been going on for quite a while, several years, and it's a low-level ache, feeling of fullness down in my lower left abdominal area, right above the pelvic bone.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's probably something to do with digestion or intestine.
Mm-hmm. Tell me, are you regular and normal bowel movements?
Yes.
Okay, good. What's the second thing?
The second thing is my left shoulder, right on the top, the muscle right on the top, up to the side of my ear, all the way, that muscle that runs from the tip of the shoulder all the way up to my ear. It's very achy.
That would be your trapezius. Are you left-handed?
No, I'm right-handed.
Okay.
And it's been about a week, just constantly achy and sore, and no matter how much I stretch or do yoga or take aspirin or, nothing seems to help. It's just very annoying and painful. And the third is something that was brief, but it happened about a week ago. My left foot, right behind the ball of my big toe, it felt like I had bruised that muscle, but there was no bruise. I don't remember doing anything. It was so painful that I could not walk. It just started in the morning while I was taking my shower, I suddenly noticed that it was very painful. And by the time, an hour later, it hurt so much I couldn't touch it. It was very tender to the touch.
Did it change color, look red or anything?
No, no swelling, no change from the outside.
And you never had that before either?
Nope.
Okay. Well, first of all, definitely are three seemingly unrelated things. I'm thinking in terms of the chi concept, and, you're not far, as I'm thinking, shoulder trapezius is kind of gallbladder meridian and small intestine meridian. Triple heater runs through there. That's the side of the body. Doesn't go anywhere near the base of the big toe. So I'm having trouble pulling that together directly, although I suppose you could argue that you've got two meridians involved. What I'm concerned about is whether or not you might have an issue around your vitamin D. I have an article here that I was going to talk about that was research done in Egypt, of all places. I thought this was interesting. When you have multiple musculoskeletal pains that bounce around in your body, they found that there's a strong correlation with low vitamin D levels. I'm not sure how to relate that to your abdominal pain. By the way, speaking just as a conventional physician, pain in that location is over your colon, and so a possible diverticulosis, like maybe chronic low-grade diverticulosis, or some ovarian issues. Certainly persistent pain in that area should prompt perhaps some non-invasive imaging investigation like an ultrasound. So I want to just throw that out there to be sure that you do the due diligence to look for the organic physical disease that might actually be dangerous. With respect to the top of the shoulder pain, that left shoulder can be referred pain from the heart or from an irritated diaphragm. However, it won't hurt when you press on the trapezius muscle. So if it hurts when you press on the muscle, it's not your heart, but it's always worth doing that test.
Yeah, it does hurt.
It's okay, good. Sensitive. You may have slept wrong. It may be from excessive stress and poor positioning at the computer terminal or something like that. That's a common area for pain. And when it isn't getting better after about a week, I generally recommend trying a massage. If there's numbness or tingling in the fingers, that's a much more serious thing that should prompt medical attention.
That actually has started happening in the last few days. My left hand has occasionally felt tingling in the fingertips, a little bit numb.
Yeah, so you might want to get that checked out. How old are you?
Almost 50.
Yeah, so you're just in that sweet spot age for disc disease. So
for what?
Discs. Yeah. The discs start going, somewhere in the 30s through the 60s. And pretty much if they're going to go, they go by the time you're 60.
Discs in the spine and the neck?
Yep. So that's a possibility if the pain's persistent and you're having tingling. Oh, it could be just spasm and trapping the nerve, in which case it'll get a lot better with body work.
Yeah, I was thinking I need a little spa weekend with the massage, acupuncture, and chiropractic all in one.
Oh, I'd do one. I'd start with the body work and start with the massage.
Okay.
Well, good luck, and I hope you feel better soon.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And let's go to our next email, and this is from Eve in Soquel. And Eve wanted to call in about the gentleman who was having trouble with his teeth. She says he needs to use proxy brushes between the teeth. This toughens up the gums, making them resistant to bacteria and makes them help hold on to the teeth. This saved my teeth. Also, you commented on potassium a while back and said it was in starchy foods like bananas, but it's also available in large amounts in dairy, foods like chicken, and a cup of organic tomato juice has 860 milligrams for a 60-calorie cup. It's in a lot of stuff. And I do want to put in a pitch, by the way, thank you, Eve, for tomato juice as a good way of getting potassium for my diabetic patients. It's a lot less starchy than a banana. We're going now to our next caller, who's Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for this wonderful community service, Dr. Dawn.
Thank you.
I have a torn rotator cuff with a slap lesion of the left glenoid labrum, and it's pretty bad from 11 o'clock to 2 o'clock.
Mm.
And I have been told by several doctors that I must have surgery. And the surgery is pretty awful, and I have been trying to rehab it. And I have been doing physical therapy, and now it's been suggested that I use either light therapy or laser therapy as an adjunct. And I've done a little bit of research, and it seems that the light therapy could be more potent than the laser therapy, but I'm just wondering if at all this can be healed.
Well, let's define healing. Because
I want to use my arm without tremendous pain.
All right. That's important because you know, you've got a tear in the cartilage. It's a tear. The cartilage does not heal spontaneously very rapidly or well, and so the chances of it sticking itself back together are low. So the surgical fix is, you know, you go in and you essentially amputate the part of the cartilage that's torn. They don't call it amputation. They call it repair.
Yes.
But it's really just removing the part that's broken, like cutting a fingernail that's partially broken and hanging by a thread. You cut the fingernail off, and that's sort of the approach to the cartilage. Now, the movement of the cartilage against itself is triggering inflammatory mediators like interleukin 6 and tumor necrosis alpha and all these other factors are causing swelling. That swelling is adding to your pain, and the inflammatory mediators are also pain neurotransmitters. And so you're getting pain, and that's restricting your movement. So reducing swelling, anti-inflammatories, things like that can be very beneficial. If you haven't already had a cortisone injection into the shoulder, that would be really one of the next steps. You want a strong local dose of anti-inflammatories. If you don't tolerate or are adverse to that, there are anti-inflammatory acupuncture protocols. There are anti-inflammatory herbs that can be beneficial in situations like this.
I've been using quite a bit of turmeric.
Okay. But is it turmeric in a form that you're absorbing into your bloodstream?
Well, Yeah, right. Turmeric and bromelain combination.
Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah, okay.
So the point is that multiple avenues of trying to get the inflammation down are an appropriate step before surgery.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I've heard from the surgeons that, you know, every patient who has this needs surgery. But obviously, all over the planet, there's plenty of people with rotator cuff tears who are managing without surgery. So there must be something that the surgeons don't know.
Right. You know, and I just wonder about the use of, you know, either the laser on it or the light therapy. And as I said, I've been doing reading and trying to decide, you know, which I should use as an adjunct.
Well, if you're going to do acupuncture as well, I would do light therapy because I think that the laser therapy that you're referring to is essentially a hybridized form of acupuncture.
Okay. Well, I'm doing physical therapy. I'm doing physical therapy, and the physical therapist wants to use the light therapy as the adjunct.
Yeah. Well, it's good. It's helpful for loosening things up, reduces spasm. You need to get the swelling down.
Right.
That's key. So I like ice, too, in a rotator cuff.
No heat? She said I should do heat and ice.
Yes, I do both.
Uh-huh,
I end with ice, but you're trying to essentially flush out the inflammatory mediators, but you also want to shrink the tissues.
Right, I think,
okay, stretching and rehabbing the shoulder, building up the back muscles, the rhomboids, which pull the shoulder back. That's so important. Don't neglect that. Stretching the pectoralis muscle, which twist the shoulder forward into a mechanically disadvantageous position.
Yeah.
That's something else that you want to be working with. Like I said, in these situations, if a person's really committed to trying to avoid surgery, I will get invasive with steroids into the shoulder to try to get that shrinkage down.
Uh-huh.
And I invite you to come and see me. There's a protocol in acupuncture called the Govecki protocol that I've done on frozen shoulders. And you may not exactly have a frozen shoulder.
I'm sorry, what's the name of the protocol?
Govecki.
Oh, thank you.
And you can look it up. It's a Canadian acupuncturist who came up with this. And it's quite astonishingly good for a frozen shoulder. In your situation, that may not be the appropriate step because you have the tear.
Right.
But I would encourage you to think outside the box on this.
That's why I'm calling.
Yes.
And I'm doing whatever research I can do.
All right. Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
It's a beautiful day. Thank you so
Bye-bye.
Much.
Bye-bye. So let's talk about a new discovery. I bet that you have a friend who can eat whatever they want and stay skinny. They're really annoying friends. Generally, they have other redeeming characteristics, which is why you still speak to them. But they are annoying people to be around. Have you ever wondered why they can do that? Well, the answer, my friends, is brown fat. Turns out we have two kinds of fat. The white fat that stores calories and also essentially is a hormonal endocrine tissue that releases hunger hormones and inflammatory hormones as well. So not the greatest thing in the world. And brown fat. Now, brown fat is brown because it's full of blood vessels and mitochondria. And it is what burns calories and turns them into heat. Now, some people have a set point such that when they eat too many calories, their body just heats up and burns them off. people with good amounts of brown fat are the skinny, the eat anything and stay skinny people. Researchers have discovered a hormone called orexin. It's produced in the brain and it activates brown fat. Now, so far, this is just in a mouse model, but mice and humans are actually fairly closely related in terms of obesity. They've gone and looked at humans and found that, yes, indeed, orexin tends to be low in obese humans. So now the thought is, well, can we synthesize this? Can we clone it? Can we make a drug that looks like it that would actually cause people to develop more brown fat and burn off their calories? It's very preliminary right now, but this could be a way to activate that latent physiology in all of us and allow us to burn off some extra fat, probably in a fashion that would not be nearly as dangerous as the drugs that we have currently available for weight loss or the surgeries. So, you know, when you mess with hormones, there's always going to be a pushback. The devil's in the details, and this is not yet ready for prime time. Okay, I've done my caveats, but nevertheless, I'm really excited about the idea that I might be prescribing people who are pre-diabetic and overweight a hormone that would cause them to rev up their physiology, much in the way that exercise does, and burn off some of those excess calories. And let's go to this rather disturbing finding published in The Lancet Infectious Disease this last week. First of all, the setup. All over Africa, there are people who are at risk for getting HIV. Zero different couples, where one couple's positive and the other, one person in the couple's positive, the other person's negative. And of course, there's not a great deal of obstetric services. Pregnancy, particularly the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth pregnancy, are dangerous for the woman. And so contraception is a huge issue. In Africa, one of the most common forms of contraception is injectable progesterone. It works very well. Unfortunately, this latest study suggests that injectable progesterone does something very interesting to the physiology in that it doubles the risk of getting HIV. So if you're a woman using this type of contraception, your risk of converting to HIV is doubled. And here's where it gets really strange. If you are the male partner of a woman who is HIV positive, who is using this form of contraception, your risk is doubled as well. So clearly, we're having some sort of effect on the cervical mucus or the vaginal mucosa or some part of the physiology. It's not affecting immunity because that wouldn't affect the partner. It's got to be changing how readily HIV is absorbed and secreted across the mucosa of the vagina. And that is a very alarming statistic. Could be a third variable. I have to throw that out. Could be that people are using dirty needles or not sterilizing the needles when they do the Depo-Provera. And that is a possible third variable here. But it still doesn't explain why the men have a higher rate. So I think that's probably not it. I want to read an email. I've sat on this one for a while because I wanted to be sure that I gave it adequate time. And I think this is a really important issue. This came from Jeff in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I was in an automobile accident. I had a spinal fracture and a herniated disc. It feels like I'm wearing a pair of gloves all the time. I'm being referred to a neurosurgeon. But the problem that Jeff is having is that he recently changed primary care doctors. And because of his pain issue, he was prescribed Lortab, which contains hydrocodone. Well, on several occasions, a friend stole his pain pills. And so he lost 3/4 of his prescription. Initially, he didn't catch it. He thought the pharmacy had shorted him. He filed a police report and he set up a hidden camera and he proved that his friend was actually stealing the drugs and he had him arrested for stealing all of his medications. The problem is his doctor doesn't believe him. He's took in the video, he took in the police reports, but his doctor is still reluctant to prescribe extra Lortab. He's been the victim of a crime in his own home and he has a pain issue and he has a credibility issue with his physician who thinks that maybe this whole thing is a scam. I recently had a phone call from a physician who is under investigation by the DEA and has basically said, I need everybody to take over my pain patients because I'm under investigation here. I can't afford to write pain meds for people who are in genuine pain. We really have a problem. with the indiscriminate use of pain meds. And we've all heard about the pain med mills in Florida, where you go and you plonk down $100 and they give you a prescription for 100 Lortab, which you can then go turn into several thousand dollars on the street. Okay, that's a real social issue. And I'm not trying to soft pedal it, but I'm also saying that we need to figure out a way to not have physicians afraid to prescribe pain meds for people. I want to stop being the drug cop here. Okay, that is really not my role. And it's inappropriate to penalize physicians. We've got to have a good way to tell the wheat from the chaff here and not have just regular primary care doctors afraid to write for drugs. And let's do another email. This one is from Margaret in Grafton, MA. Is that Massachusetts? I think so. I listen to you via computer. Enjoy your show. At 40, a month after weaning my third child while working at a high-stress job and facing divorce, I had an episode of extreme PMS/panic attacks. My OB-GYN sent me to an endocrinologist who diagnosed a hot toxic thyroid nodule. This is not good to eat, hot toxic thyroid nodule, and received radiation treatment. After all, levels were in the normal range, but within a few months, I gained 30 pounds and fell into a profound depression for which I've been taking antidepressants ever since, and I also take statins for hyperlipidemia. In the intervening 17 years, I've gone to the ER 3 times with vague but distressing symptoms, including chest pain. The first time I was diagnosed without diagnoses, only EKGs. The most recent time, my enzyme levels were also checked, prompting additional tests, which revealed an old heart attack and 15% artery blockage. It seems my arteries spasm periodically. My cardiologist and I spend most of my visits to him shrugging to one another. My real complaint is that I am often, but not always, extremely tired. It comes in waves and is irresistible. I can't count on being able to drive an hour without having the overwhelming urge to fall asleep. Reading puts me to sleep almost instantly, and sleep is rarely refreshing. This has been very limiting to both my work and social life. I had a sleep study done, but nothing came of it. My question is it possible there's some underlying related deficiency that can be tested for and possibly treated? And she goes on to talk about what medications she's taking, all very appropriate. She walks 2 miles a day, eats fairly, properly, doesn't smoke or drink, but feels I'm barely just alive. Can you throw me a clue? Well, I think I can throw you more than a clue, Margaret. I think I can throw you a rope here. I think what happened was at the time that you were treated back with the radiation for your thyroid nodule, you sustained adrenal damage. It may have actually been from the panic attacks and the waxing and waning, but whatever the cause, I think that you are now in a position where you no longer have a normal adrenal pattern of biorhythm. Typically, that is manifested by weight gain. Depression is very common. The best description I've ever heard of it is chronic jet lag. The arteries spasming periodically could also be associated with occasional spurts of adrenaline from a dysregulated adrenal gland. So that may actually have been, at some level, causative to your cardiac disease. You need to find a functional medical doctor, maybe an ND, which is a naturopath. The testing that I would start with would be adrenal cycle saliva testing. And for those of you who don't believe in saliva testing, let me just say I didn't used to believe in saliva testing, and I still don't think that it is quantitative. In other words, if I do saliva levels on 100 people and match them to their serum levels, there's going to be differences in the correlation. On the other hand, if I do saliva levels in the same individual over time, those levels are going to tell me about relative cortisol levels in their bloodstream fairly accurately. And that's what we're looking for when we try to identify these circadian rhythms. The best test, well, that would be taking the person's blood every 4 hours round the clock. That's expensive and extremely difficult to pull off. So saliva testing is a second best way of looking at that body clock. And if indeed there are signs of adrenal exhaustion, people can actually take artificial forms of cortisol, or they can take herbs. Sometimes people actually use extracts from animal adrenal glands to try and restore the gland. It depends on how severely damaged it is. But the most important thing here is that there is potentially help, and you shouldn't just stop when conventional medicine shrugs at you. Then it's really time to go unconventional. I'm glad you were checked for sleep apnea. That would have been my first thought. Well, you've heard of snake oil. And, of course, you've heard of shark cartilage for cancer, which I don't think is a particularly well-validated alternative therapy, just by the way. However, a new compound derived from sharks may turn out to be a very useful antiviral. This compound, known as squalamine, has been studied in human clinical trials for treating cancer and eye disorders, and it's shown to be fairly safe in humans, which is important because in recent tissue culture studies, it's shown to inhibit the infection of human blood vessel cells by dengue virus, and we don't have anything that prevents dengue, and it's been shown to inhibit infection of human liver cells by hepatitis B and D. It also, in animal studies, I should say, has worked for yellow fever, Eastern equine encephalitis virus, and murine cytomegalovirus. These are viruses for which we do not have any treatments. So shark derivative squalamine, a new potential antiviral therapy, already shown to be safe in humans. Stay tuned for more information. Let's talk to Sarah in Live Oak. Hello, Sarah. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have the nephew up in Washington with the large cancer tumor around his stomach and spleen and esophagus. And they're seeking out alternative methods. He went through two rounds of chemo now and two rounds of radiation. And so my sister is checking out high-pec hot chemo abdominal bath.
I'm sorry, say that again.
High-pec, H-I-P-E-C. And then it's hot chemo is actually injected into the abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
To surround the free-floating cancer cells.
Got it. Okay.
And for about, I think it's like 15 minutes or so, or an hour, I don't know.
This sounds like what they call in football a Hail Mary pass.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, you don't have anything to offer except the most extreme and radical sort of, let's give this a try.
So they're doing it at Sutter, some of the Sutter hospitals,
mm-hmm.
and the one in Sacramento is doing it.
Right.
And the one up in Seattle.
What's your question?
So the one in Sacramento said, no, I can't do it. You got to go back and try to shrink that tumor some more.
Yeah.
The one in Seattle said, oh, no, I don't even want to meet you because you're not a candidate for this. But didn't say exactly why.
Mm-hmm.
So then the phone call comes from Des Moines because my sister is letting all these doctors know she's seeking it out. And the doctor in Des Moines says, yes, come on, I'll check you out. I think I'll do it for you.
All right. So what's your question?
What would you do?
Well, I would probably, myself, if I had that cancer,
yeah,
I'd stay home and work on an art piece and walk on the beach and make my peace with God.
Yeah.
Because there is a point where we're all going to die.
Yeah.
And if I had that level of advanced cancer, I'd want to spend my last moments comfortable. I would not have much faith that I would derive a benefit.
Yeah.
If I was feeling generous and wanted to do something for humanity instead of doing something for myself, then I might enroll in a clinical trial with the idea that it'll probably kill me, but maybe they'll learn something that would make it useful for somebody else.
Uh-huh.
So yeah. I guess it's a matter of personal decision,
yeah.
But I think we've got as a society to accept the fact that sometimes young people die of terrible diseases, and when you have a terrible disease and everyone is flailing, and that's what this is a flail.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe you don't play. Maybe you just accept the hand you've been dealt.
Okay, a side question. Do you think Steve Jobs thought out all kinds of alternative treatments?
In terms of alternative treatments, I don't know, but I believe that he had a liver transplant, which is
a
fairly radical approach to pancreatic cancer. To my knowledge, there's never been a case of pancreatic cancer metastatic that was cured by a liver transplant. It bought him some time, and he used that time how he chose to use that time.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of respect for him as a person and for his accomplishments.
Yeah, me too.
And for that matter, for the way he conducted himself during his disease.
Yeah.
It's absolutely a personal, private choice.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes his family members, I've saw this phenomenon just recently with my dearest friend whose mother had stage 3 colon cancer and was 86 and wanted to die, and neither he nor his sister were quite able to get on board with that wish.
Mm-hmm.
They had a hard time respecting their mother's dying wishes because they didn't want her to die.
And at 86, huh?
At 86.
Yeah.
So imagine how the family members feel when you're 26.
Yeah.
We have to stop pressuring people we have to respect the rights of our patients with their cancers to make their own decisions.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, his mother is the one that's seeking out all these alternatives.
What do you expect?
Yeah, that's what she says. What am I supposed to do?
But she needs to let him off the hook and say, if you don't want to go there, I understand.
Yeah.
She shouldn't make her son die in pain because she can't stand to see him die.
Yeah,
she needs to get over that one.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.